This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, June 16th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Several years ago, Iyad Akhtar debuted his play Disgraced, which centers on the subject of Muslim American identity post 9/11. This year, it is the most produced play in the country. Here's a scene from the Lincoln Center production.
So what's it like for you?
What?
Airport security. I mean, you hear stories.
I wouldn't know. We cut right to the chase.
He volunteers himself, goes up to the agents, and offers himself up.
What?
To be served?
Mm-hmm. Look, I figure they're looking at me. It's not because I look like Giselle. Why not make it easier for everyone involved?
I've never heard of anybody doing that before.
Well, on top of people being more and more afraid of people who look like me, we end up being resented.
Those agents are working hard not to discriminate, then here comes this guy and just calls them out.
Pure, unmitigated, passive aggression, my wife likes to call it.
I think maybe she's got a point.
Iyad won the Pulitzer Prize for Disgraced in 2013. He joins me to talk about the Muslim American experience today. Hi, Iyad. Welcome.
Hi, Dorothy. Thanks for having me.
So in the play, in the course of a single dinner party, Amir, who is a corporate lawyer, reckons with his Pakistani heritage and his American identity. It doesn't go well. Tell us a little bit about the scene we just heard.
That's the third scene of the play, which is the centerpiece of the play. And, you know, Amir has been hiding his Muslim and Pakistani origins from his mostly Jewish bosses at the mergers and acquisitions law firm that he works at. And over the course of the play, that secret, if you will, gradually comes out. And the section that you just heard takes place the evening that it really looks certain that things are going south for him at the firm. And there's a colleague over for dinner, and he has way too much to drink. And he starts speaking his mind in ways that he probably never should. And yeah, basically, his life falls apart by the end of that scene.
Can you just tell us a tiny bit about your own background? You grew up in Milwaukee. You are the child of Pakistani Americans yourself.
Yeah. My folks are both doctors. They came over on a program after the U.S. government changed the quotas on immigration from the subcontinent. They came over on a program that gave them visas, apartments, jobs, and plane tickets because they were both doctors. And the United States needed scientists in the sort of science and technology push post-JFK. My dad came in 68. My mom came in 69. My dad ended up moving the family out to Wisconsin. I was born in New York. My mom never forgave him for that, moving her out to the hinterlands. Yeah, I grew up in Wisconsin, and I've written about it in a novel called American Dervish. I didn't feel out of place. I felt different, but I didn't feel, you know, it was just pre-9/11, so there wasn't really the same kind of atmosphere that there is now.
So that brings us to where we are today with the mass shootings in Orlando, after which Donald Trump said yet again that he wants to ban Muslims from emigrating to America. So we've talked a lot on this program this year about the xenophobia and racism that are now known by the name Trumpism, at least to his opponents. You've been writing about these themes for your entire career. And I wondered, how do American citizens who happen to be Muslim grapple with the moment we're in right now?
With difficulty. Every time there's a terrorist attack, a so-called terrorist attack, you know, there's a shudder of dread and fear that goes through the community. I have members of my family don't leave the house for days after one of those attacks. It's complicated. It's not easy to talk about in sound bites because, you know, in our culture today, it appears that there really is no middle ground. Either you are on one side or the other. And so everyone is looking to figure out what your point of view is. So having a nuanced conversation about Islam and the West, about post 9/11, sort of the new global world order, all of those things are difficult to undertake. I think one of the things that I find interesting about Muslim experience or experience of many Muslims post 9/11 is that there really is no place for nuance in our own experience. We have a long genealogy, a long history of colonial and post-colonial grievances, post-colonial wounds. We come from cultures in many cases, you know, I certainly do in my parents' Pakistani culture, where there's a long complicated legacy of a relationship to Britain, to the Great Game, to America. In a post 9/11 world, it's almost impossible to admit to dual loyalty. As a Muslim in this country, you've got to be a card-carrying member of the American flag in all of its sort of unthinking jingoism.
You've said my characters aren't Muslim. They are characters. But you also show, as we were just discussing, that they can't escape their identity as Muslims.
That's the case with Disgraced. You know, I wrote another play called The Who and the What, in which many people have commented there doesn't seem to be any self-consciousness about being Muslim. Or American Dervish, where the book is in many ways just about my sense of the American experience of faith from the Muslim point of view. You know, I often think, following Bloom, Harold Bloom, that there is something exceptional about the American religion, that there is a sense in which we, as Americans, see ourselves individually with the uncreated, with God, that there is some individualist tenor to the sacred experience for us as Americans that actually speaks to our obsession with individualism in our national life, that those two things, there's a continuum there. And so American Dervish is an attempt to express that kind of singularity. What you were saying about Disgraced is true, that the subject of Disgraced in many ways is that a man who wishes to define himself in stark opposition to everything that he comes from and wishes to prove his bona fides as a secular individual is not allowed to forget the fact that he is fundamentally Muslim.
Audiences are disturbed and often baffled by the play, but you said that African Americans tend to immediately understand it. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think picking up on what I just said, once a Muslim, always a Muslim, you know, the whole thing of one drop of black blood makes you black in this country. It was interesting. Susan Booth in Atlanta programmed the play at the Alliance in her very, very large theater, and I was perplexed. And I went down to do an event with her, and she said, you know, I read this play, and I felt like I wanted to do a play that was about race in America, but that was not the same conversation we always have in this city. And there was a huge African-American contingent that came to see the play, and there was a very, very vociferous sort of response.
So interesting. You mentioned yesterday, too, that you were – maybe it was the same event in Atlanta, but you had given a talk and you were approached by an Iranian woman who was quite critical, and then by a white man in his 60s who defended you.
Well, you know, I often get this, that Muslims will come up to me afterwards and say, you know, you got to be an ambassador for the faith. You got to do a better job. You know, I wrote American Dervish. I would get letters of, why are you not writing a book that's making people want to be Muslim? You should write a book that makes people want to be Muslim. So with Disgrace, she was sort of chiding me a little bit for, you know, not doing a better job of explaining Islam to people and why it's a beautiful thing. And, you know, I tried to explain to her that I didn't see that that was my job. And I was not an ad guy or an advocate for, you know, Islam. Islam doesn't need an apologist. It doesn't need somebody. It's a very robust tradition. There was a white guy in his 60s just standing behind her. And as she left, he came up to me. He said, you know, I got to tell you, I saw your show on Broadway and I didn't see anything about Islam. I mean, I know it's there, but that was not what I came away with. You know, I spent my whole life in the military and I had Latino and black officers above me and Latino and black soldiers below me. And I saw men my whole life struggle with their careers and struggle with their place because they couldn't figure out where their loyalties really lay. And that was the man that I saw in your play. Mm. It's very moving.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This week, President Obama spoke about the difference between ISIS, homegrown terrorists, and ordinary Americans.
The Orlando killer, one of the San Bernardino killers, the Fort Hood killer, they were all U.S. citizens. Are we going to start treating all Muslim Americans differently? It won't make us more safe. It will make us less safe, fueling ISIL's notion that the West hates Muslims, making young Muslims in this country and around the world feel like no matter what they do, they're going to be under suspicion and under attack. It makes Muslim Americans feel like their government is betraying them.
Hillary Clinton said much the same thing. Yet this kind of thing just fires up Trump and his followers. In fact, Trump describes Obama as anti-American.
Yeah, I don't know what Trump's idea of America is. I mean, I feel like one of the big dilemmas that we have is that we don't know what we means. You know, as animals, we like to know without thinking about it what we are. So when you have a contiguous ethno-racial identity, there really is no need to reflect on the we. The we is obvious. It's obvious in terms of what we see and how we speak. And I think that, you know, we're entering an era where that we is really not clear. That we is beginning to disintegrate in terms of its coherence. Supplanting it with an idea is a challenge. It takes education. You know, I often say democracy is meaningless without education. So, you know, here we are, one of the, you know, the richest nation in the world, gutting our education and, you know, extolling the virtues of democracy, which we can't even seem to understand on a very fundamental level.
And we have an African-American president who has served two terms, who came into office determined to basically present the message that you just made. And yet, the country has become increasingly divisive since, and Trump is using that to whip up racial animosity of all kinds.
I said recently in an interview something about there are these pockets of irrationality that open up cyclically in American history, and we're seeing yet another with perhaps greater consequence or perhaps less. We'll see. We don't know. Again, the idea that Obama, that his ascension to the throne, if you will, somehow marks a shift at the level of intuitive recognition of what we are and our identity is not foregone conclusion. It's the coded language of race baiting within politics. That animus toward the underclass, the racial underclass, has erupted now that you have the very thing that they've been trying to avoid staring at them on television, telling them how to live their lives. There's a black man in the White House. Well, we've been talking about how big government actually really means don't give money to black people. That's what it really means. And now we got a black guy in the Oval Office. It makes people apoplectic. And so to somehow think that we were not that country is to not understand our history.
Tell us a little bit about your next play, which deals with yet another crisis that's been building over the decades and in some ways is a version of what we're talking about.
Absolutely. I think that our real problems have less to do with identity politics and more to do with the sort of subtle and encompassing way that global power has become united to late capitalist financial systems.
I should say, by the way, that it's called Junk,
yeah.
The Golden Age of Debt.
Yes. It's basically a fantasia on the events of the 80s that resulted in a shift in American thinking where we began to think of debt as an asset. You know, debt was never an asset. Debt was something that figured the original sin of human existence, you know, the debt to life, which has to be paid off through the curse of work. And at some point, we as a nation, I think, embraced the notion of debt as something to unlock wealth. And of course, it created an extraordinary amount of wealth. It has come at a cost. And I think there are philosophical nuances to this that are important to our national life. And so anyway, the play is I take a leverage buyout deal that turns into a hostile takeover, and I put the entire deal on stage. The play begins at the beginning of the deal and ends at the end of the deal. So it's a sort of attempt to embody or embed the audience in the process of capital and to watch in real time the consequences on individuals, but also on the economy.
It's just interesting to me the way you focus on economic themes and ethnic themes and the way they resonate with each other.
Well, in Junk, another major subplot of, or not even subplot, is that a group of young Jewish financiers are trying to overthrow or overtake the old blue blood WASP order, which is, of course, what the history of the 80s in finance really was. So it's the same issue in a way.
Going back to what you were saying earlier about the era of Trump, do you think this is just part of one of these cyclical moments and that we will come out of it and move ahead? Or are we seeing something that's deeper and more disturbing?
You know, I think it's been a few generations now that meaning and language have been decoupled. But I think we're seeing a new disrespect or disregard for the truth value of language. And I think that without meaningful education, there really is nothing to stem the tide of this avalanche of ignorance that seems to be engulfing our national consciousness. Asimov wonderfully said about a streak of anti-intellectualism in American life that my ignorance is as good as your knowledge, that that's the way that a lot of people think. And that's really, it's in many ways, is the sort of aphorism of our time. How do we combat that?
Okay. Thank you so much, Ayad.
Thank you.
Ayad Akhtar is a playwright, novelist, screenwriter, and actor, and the winner of the 2013 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com or on the New Yorker apps, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. And you can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The Political Scene is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.